on paper, and get that paper to Master Callus? Right you are. Next, consider every door in the entire structure that you routinely keep locked, excepting the guest rooms, of course. Have all the locks changed, every last one. Do it tomorrow, during business hours. Nikoros will reimburse you from party funds.
Aye,
said Nikoros. Nikoros, your job this afternoon is to say yes to anything that comes out of my mouth. The more you rehearse this, the sooner it'll become a smooth mechanical process allowing no time for painful reflection. Can you practice for me?
Yes.
You're a natural. Anyway, Justin, get locksmiths down here tomorrow, even if you have to promise them a month's pay. Make sure your fresh hirelings don't get new keys. Arrange to make it look like the locksmiths have simply run out. Tell them they'll get theirs in a few days. We'll see if any of them do anything interesting as a result. Clear so far? Justin nodded and tapped his right temple with one finger. Next, get a metalsmith to bang up some simple neck chains for all of your employees. Dignified but cheap. Gilded iron. Nothing anyone would want to pawn. This is important. We don't want some enterprising spy throwing together an outfit to mimic one of your waiters so they can lurk about. Anyone on duty wears a chain. Anyone working without a chain gets hauled in back for an impolite conversation. Nobody takes their chain with them when they leave, or they're fired. Got it? Chains get handed in to you and your most trusted associates, and donned again when it's time to start a new shift. Once you've seen to that, announce to all of your employees that you're doubling their wages until the day after the election. Nikoros will reimburse you out of party funds.
Yes, said Nikoros.
Mention also, said Locke, the importance of preserving a secure house during the election, and that anyone reporting anything genuinely unusual or out of place will be compensated for their trouble. If a spider farts in a wine cellar, I want you to hear about it. Justin's eyes had widened, but he nodded as before. What else? Physical security. We need brutes, say half a dozen. Reliable types, patient, ready for a scrap, but not slobbering to start one. No idiots. And some women we can blend in with the crowd. Handy things, pretty girls with knives under their skirts. Where can we get some?
The Court of Dust, said Nikoros. The caravan staging and receiving posts. There's always guards for hire. Not exactly collegium scholars, mind you.
Just so long as they don't suck their thumbs in polite company, said Locke. See to it tomorrow, Nikoros, and take Master Callus with you. He can sort cream from crap. Clean up the new recruits, get them decent clothes, and put them up here for the duration. Pay for the rooms out of party funds. Also, make it clear that anyone brought on as muscle answers directly to me or Callus. They take no orders from anyone else without our permission.
Sure, said Nikoros.
Now, Nikoros, you have an office full of papers to preserve. Run off and get your scribe working. Take the steps we discussed earlier. What time are you parading us around?
9th hour of the evening.
Good, good. Shit, wait. Will everyone in attendance know that Callus and I are running the show?
No, only the members of the committee. We did hire you, remember?
Ah, said Locke. That's fine. You carry on with getting the hell out of here, and we'll see you tonight. Nikoros nodded, shook hands with Justin, and went out the front door. What else? Locke turned back to Justin. Rooms, yes. The rooms adjacent to our suite and across from it are not to be let. Keep them vacant. Have Nikoros pay you the full 6 weeks' rent for them out of party funds, but give the keys for the empty rooms to me, right?
Easily done.
Jean studied Locke carefully. This rapid transition to a state of wide-eyed, energetic scheming was something he'd seen many times before. However, there was a nervous, feverish quality to Locke's mood that made Jean bite his lip with concern.
What else?
Luncheon, perhaps? Jean interrupted as gracefully as he could.
Food, wine, coffee? A few minutes to sit down and catch your breath in private?
Food, yes. Coffee and wine are a ghastly mix. One or the other, I don't care which. Not both.
As for food, sir, said Justin,
put anything on my plate short of a live scorpion and I'll eat it. And... Locke snapped his fingers. I know what I've forgotten. Justin, have you had any new customers in the past few days?
Particularly new customers, never seen before, ones that spend a great deal of time sitting around? Well, now that you mention it, don't stare at them, but on your right, far side of the room, the third table from the rear wall, under the painting of the lady with the exceptional bosom necklace.
I see, said Locke. Yes, that is an extraordinary place to hang a necklace.
Three men?
First started coming here 3 days ago. They eat and drink more than enough to keep their spot, but they keep it for hours at a time, and they come and go in shifts sometimes. There's a fourth fellow not there right now.
Do they have rooms?
No, and they don't do business with a regular crowd. Sometimes they play cards, but mostly, well, I don't know what they do. Nothing offensive.
Would you call them gentlemen, in their manner of dress, in their self-regard?
Well, they're not penniless, but I wouldn't go so far as gentlemen.
Hirelings, said Locke, removing some of the more obvious pieces of jewelry Nicoras had secured for him and stuffing them into a coat pocket.
Valets, professional men of convenience, unless I miss my guess. I'm a little overdressed for this, but I think I can compensate by toning down my manners.
Overdressed for what? Said Jean.
Insulting complete strangers, said Locke, loosening his neckcloth. Got to mind the delicate social nuances when you inform some poor fellow that he's a dumb motherfucker.
8. Hang on, said Jean. If you're looking to start a fight, I'm...
I thought about that, said Locke. You're likely to scare them. I need them to feel insulted and not threatened. That makes it my job.
Well, would you like me to intervene before you get your teeth punched out, or is that part of your scheme?
If I'm right, said Locke, you won't need to. If I'm wrong, I grant you full license to indulge in an I-told-you-so when I'm conscious again, with an option for a you-stupid-bastard, if you choose.
I'll claim that privilege.
The quick-moving waiter appeared with a second cup of coffee for Jean. He seized it and slapped a pair of copper coins down in its place. The waiter bowed.
Justin, said Locke, if it turns out I'm about to do something knavish to honest customers, we'll compensate you.
Going to be a damned interesting 6 weeks, muttered Justin. Locke took a deep breath, cracked his knuckles, and walked over to the table at which the three strangers sat. Jean stayed some distance behind, minding his cup of coffee. His presence there was a comfort, familiar as a shadow.
Good afternoon, said Locke. Lazari is my name. I trust I'm intruding.
I'm sorry, said the man closest to Locke, but we were...
I'm afraid I don't care, said Locke. He slid into an unclaimed chair and appraised the strangers.
Young, clean, well-groomed, not quite expensively dressed. They were sharing a bottle of white wine and a pitcher of water.
We were having a private discussion, said the man on Locke's right.
Ah, but I'm here to do you two a service,
Locke gestured at the two men sitting across from him. Concerning the fellow I'm sitting next to.
Word around the bar is that he can only get it up when he's on top of another fellow he's taken by force or subterfuge.
What the hell is this?
Hissed the man on the right.
Phrased less delicately, said Locke, if you continue to associate with this well-known deceiver, he's going to tie you down, do you somewhere very untidy until you bleed, and not bother to untie you after.
This is unseemly, said one of the men across the table. Unseemly, and if you don't withdraw immediately...
I'd be more worried about your friend not withdrawing immediately, said Locke. He's not known for being quick.
What's the meaning of this infantile interruption?
The man on Locke's right pounded on the table, just strongly enough to rattle the bottle and glasses.
Good gods, said Locke, pretending to notice the wine for the first time. You thoroughly artless fuckstains didn't actually drink any of that, did you?
He swept his hat off and used it to knock the wine glasses of the men across from him into their laps.
You bastard, said one.
Why, I sputtered the other. But then maybe it's not drugged after all.
Locke grabbed the bottle and took a long swig.
Wouldn't need to be for Cathani. Milk-sucking pants pissers could get drunk off the smell of an empty bottle.
I'll fetch the landlord,
said the man across from him on the left, retrieving his empty glass from his lap.
"Frightening," said Locke. "Savage as a kitten on a tit. Say, did you ever hear the one about the rich Carthani and the Carthani who knew who his mother was? Shit, wait, I said Carthani, didn't I? Told the damn thing wrong."
"Leave," said the man on his right. "Leave now."
"Hey, how does a Carthani find out his wife is having her monthly flow? He crawls into his son's bed and the boy's cock is already wet. Ha! Oh, have you heard the one about the Carthani who claimed he could count to five?" The man on Locke's right pushed his chair away from the table and stood up. Locke grabbed him by the lapel. The man halted, glowering. Locke didn't have the strength to drag him back down if he decided to fight, but the crucial insult of the uninvited touch was already given. "Where are you off to?" said Locke. "I haven't finished my sensitive cultural exchange."
"Remove your hand from my coat, you obnoxious!"
"Or else what?"
"We take this to the master of the house."
"I am the master of the house," said Locke, "and you already know it. You've been sent here to watch for my coming. See the hefty gentleman 10 yards behind me? He's the other one you're looking for. Take a long, careful look, children. I don't doubt that your mistress expects a detailed report." The man jerked away. "Come now," said Locke reasonably, taking another swig from the wine bottle. "No men with any quantity of self-respect could have borne the abuse I've just given you. If you were gentlemen, you'd have called me out, and if you were roughs, you'd have punched me in the teeth. The fact is, you've been paid a tidy sum to sit here spying on me, and you were all confused as hell about what to do when I pissed on your dignity." The two men across the table started to rise, and Locke gestured sharply for them to remain seated. "Don't do anything stupid now, sirs. There's no retrieving your situation. Lift one finger in an unkind act, and I guarantee it'll take 6 months for your bones to knit. I'll also have 50 witnesses swearing you had it coming."
"What do you want with us?" muttered the man on the right.
"Haul your pathetic carcasses out the door. Be quick and polite. If I ever see you within shouting distance of Justin's again, you'll wake up in an alley with all your teeth shoved up your ass. That goes for your absent friend, too." Locke put his hat back on, stood up and strolled casually away. He spared a smile for Jean, who raised his coffee cup in salute. The scrape of chairs against the floor behind him told Locke that the men were departing in haste. He and Jean watched them leave.
"You really are a vulgar little cuss when the spirit moves you," said Jean.
"I've got worse," said Locke, "stored on some high shelf in my mind like an alchemist's poisons. Got most of it from Carlo and Galdo."
"Well, you were venomous enough for our obvious friends."
"Yes, obvious. A fine thing to chase out the conspicuous spies. Now all we have to worry about are the capable ones." 9. Locke destroyed an excellent luncheon for 6. Jean contented himself with a small corner of the feast, and came away grateful for not losing any limbs, then dozed fitfully in their suite of rooms, alternating naps in a lounging chair with episodes of furious pacing. As the sun set and the tiny fragments of sky visible around the window curtains turned black, men from Morena's delivered the beginnings of the promised wardrobe. Locke and Jean examined the new coats, vests, and breeches for concealed needles or alchemical dusts before hanging them in the massive rosewood armoires provided with the rooms. At the 8th hour of the evening, maids and porters appeared with tubs of steaming water. Locke tested each tub with a finger, and, when his flesh didn't peel from his bones, allowed that they might just be safe for their intended use. By the time Nikoros knocked 40 minutes later, the two gentleman bastards were cleaned up and comfortably ensconced in clothes that fit perfectly.
"Gentlemen," said Nikoros, who had substantially upgraded his own clothes, "I've brought you some useful things, I hope."
He passed a leather portfolio to Locke, who flipped it open and found at least 100 pages inside. Some were covered with dense scribbling that was surely Nikoros, others with flawless script that surely wasn't.
"Deep Roots Party financial reports," said Nikoros.
important membership lists, plans and minutes from the last election, lists of properties and agents, matching lists for what we know of the Black Iris, copies of the city election laws.
Splendid, said Locke. And you took all the steps I discussed earlier?
My scribe's still working, but everything else is seen to. If the earth should open up and swallow my offices, I swear I won't be losing anything irreplaceable.
Good, said Locke. Want a drink? We've got a liquor cabinet. No, wait, I haven't examined the bottles yet, sorry.
I'm sure anything provided by Justin is perfectly safe, said Nikoros, raising his eyebrows.
It's not Justin's faithfulness I worry about.
Well, let me assure you that we don't throw parties in Carthane for the purpose of staying dry.
He reached inside his coat and drew out two ornate silver lapel badges attached to green ribbons. An identical ornament was on his own left breast, though his was gold.
As for that, I mustn't forget your colors.
The official Deep Roots plumage, said Jean, extending a hand for his pin.
Yes. For the party tonight, committee members wear gold pins, conseil members wear jade, privileged others wear silver. These will mark you as men to respect, but not men who need to be followed around and remarked upon, if you don't wish it.
Good, said Locke, decorating his lapel. Now that we're properly garnished, let's serve ourselves up to the family.
10. The entire character of Jostin's main room had changed for the evening. The number of attendants at the street doors had doubled, and their uniforms were far more impressive. Dark green banners hung from the rafters and down the varnished pillars. Carriages could be heard coming and going constantly, and Locke caught a glimpse of several more attendants outside, holding their hands up to a party of well-dressed men without green ribbons. Clearly the party was a closed affair. Were the men on the pavement legitimately uninformed late diners, or some sort of opposition mischief? There was no time to investigate. A string quintet was bowing away pleasantly in one of the upper galleries, and all the visible fireplaces had huge kettles for tea and coffee bubbling before them. Curtained tables held thousands of glass bottles, and enough decanters, flutes, pitchers, and tumblers to blind every eye in the city with the force of their reflected light. Locke blinked several times and turned his attention to the men and women flowing into the room.
"This is already well more than 150," he said.
"These things happen," said Nikoros, giggling energetically as though at some private joke. "We plan with such restraint, but there's so many people we can't afford to offend."
Locke peered at him. Nikoros had changed somehow in the few minutes between their room and the party. He was sweating profusely, his cheeks were flushed, his eyes darted around like little creatures trapped behind glass panes. Yet he wasn't nervous. He was beatific. Gods! Their Straight Arrow trade insurer, their liaison to the Deep Roots upper crust, was a taker of Akadris dust. Locke smelled the sharp, pine-like odor of the stuff. Damn! Akadris, muse of fire, the poet-killer. Liquor soothed and loosened wits, but dust did the opposite, lighting fires in the mind until the dust head shook with excitement for no discernible reason. It was an expensive and incrementally suicidal habit.
"Nikoros," said Locke, grabbing one of his lapels, "you and I need to have a very frank discussion about..."
"Via Lupa! Via Lupa, dear boy!"
A ponderous old man with a face like a seamed pink pudding bore down on them, Witchwood Cane tapping the floor excitedly. The man's white eyebrows fluttered like wisps of smoke, and his lapel badge was polished jade.
"Nikoros of the Wolves, so called for his profit margins! Ha!
Good evening, Your Honor!"
Nikoros used the interruption to extricate himself from Locke's grasp.
"Oh, gentlemen, may I present first son Epitalus, conseil member for Issus Thedra for 45 years. Some would call him the, figurehead on our political vessel."
"So, I'm a figurehead, am I? A helpless woman splashing about without the good sense to cover my tits? Do I need to send a friend along to require an explanation of that remark, young fellow?
Leave the poor boy alone first. It's quite clear that you do have the good sense to cover your tits.
A lean, grizzled woman took Epitalis by the arm in a friendly fashion. She looked a lived-in 60 to Locke, though she had lively eyes and a mischievous smile. She, too, wore a jade badge, and as she and Epitalis burst into laughter, Nikoros joined in nervously, louder than either of them.
"And allow me to also present,
It was only a momentary lapse, but the woman seized upon it eagerly.
"Oh, say the name, Nikoros. It won't burn your tongue."
Damned Superstition Dexa, Conseil member for Issas Melia, and head of the Deep Roots Committee.
"Damned Superstition?" said Locke, smiling despite himself. "Which it is," said Dexa. "Though you'll note I play firmly by the rules anyway. Hypocrisy and caution are such affectionate cousins."
"Your honors," said Nikoros. Please allow me the pleasure of introducing Masters Lazari and Callus."
Bows, handshakes, nods, and endearments were exchanged with the speed of a melee, and once all the appropriate strokes had been made, their honors immediately relapsed into informality.
"So you're the gentleman that we've discussed so often recently," said Dexa. "I understand you smoked some vipers out of our midst this very afternoon."
"Hardly vipers, Your Honor. Just a few turds our opposition threw into the road to see if we were minding our feet," said Locke.
"Well, keep it up," said Epitalis. "We have such confidence in you, my lads, such confidence."
Locke nodded and felt a flutter in his guts. These people certainly hadn't read a single note on the fictional exploits of Lazari and Callus. Their warmth and enthusiasm had been installed by the spells of the Bonds Magi. Would it last forever, or dissolve like some passing fancy once the election was over? Could it dissolve before then, by accident? An unnerving thought. Nikoros managed to herd their little group toward the gleaming mountains of liquor. While his heart-to-heart with Nikoros had been postponed by the circumstances, Locke did feel more comfortable once he'd secured a drink. A glass in the hand seemed as much a uniform requirement as a green ribbon on the chest for this affair. Epitalis and Dexa soon went off to tend to the business of being important. Nikoros whirled Locke and Jean around the room several times, making introductions, pointing out prodigies and curiosities, committee members, friends, cousins, cousins of friends, and friends of cousins. Locke had once been used to mingling with the aristocracy of Camor, and while the upper crust of Carthane lacked for nothing in terms of wit and pomp, there seemed to be a distinct difference in character that ran deeper than mere variations of habit between East and West. It took half an hour of conversation for him to finally apprehend the nature of the contrast. The Carthani gentry lacked the martial quality that was omnipresent in the well-to-do of most other city-states. There were no obvious battle scars, no missing arms within pinned-up jacket sleeves, no men and women with the measured step of old campaigners or the swagger of equestrians. Locke recalled that the army of Carthane had been disbanded when the Magi took up their residence. For 4 centuries, the ominous presence had been the city's sole and entirely sufficient protection against outside interference. Introductions and pleasantries continued. "Now who's that fellow over there?" said Locke, sipping at his second Osterschall in brandy and water. "The one with the odd little hat."
"The natty-hatted gentleman? Damn, his name escapes me at the moment."
Nikoros took a generous gulp of wine as though it might help. Whatever aid it rendered was not instantaneous.
"Sorry, but I do know his particular friend, the one at his shoulder, one of our district organizers, First Son Cholmond, always claims to be writing a book."
"What sort?" said Jean.
"History, a grand historical study of the city of Carthane."
"God's grant him a paralyzing carriage accident," said Jean.
"I sympathize. Most historians have always struck me as perpetrators of tedium," said Nikoros. "He swears that his book is different. Still..."
Whatever Nikoros might have said next was lost in a general uproar.
First son Epitalus had ascended to one of the upper galleries, and he was waving for something resembling order from the crowd, which had by now soaked up a good fraction of its own weight in liquor.
"Good evening, good evening, good evening!"
yelled Epitalus.
"Good evening!"
And then, as though anyone in the audience might conceivably remain unenlightened as to the quality or time of day,
"Good evening!"
The string quintet ceased its humming and twanging, and the general acclamation sank to a tipsy murmur.
"Welcome, dear hearts and cavaliers, devoted friends, to the 79th season of elections in our Republic of Carthane. Take a moment, I pray, to reflect with pity on how few of us remain who can remember the first."
Good-natured laughter rippled across the crowd.
"Even those of you still moist behind the ears should be able to recall our heroic efforts of 5 years past, which, despite furious opposition, preserved our strong minority of 9 seats on the Conseil."
Curiously raucous cheers echoed across the hall for some time. Locke winced. Strong minority? Was he missing out on some bit of Carthani drollery, or were they really that incapable of admitting they'd lost?
"And so, surely, the burden of defending their old gains rests heavily on our foes, and must render them eminently vulnerable to what's coming their way this time."
This was answered with full-throated yells, the clinking of glasses, applause, and the sound of at least one thin-blooded reveller succumbing to the influence of complimentary liquor. Fortunately, his tumble from a balcony was interrupted by a crowd of soft-bodied folks, who were deep enough in their cups to take no offence at his sudden arrival. Waiters discreetly removed the poor fellow while Epitalus went on.
"Might I beg you, therefore, to raise a glass in toast to our dear opposition, the overconfident lads and lasses across the city? What shall we wish them, eh? Confusion? Frustration?"
"They're already confused," yelled damned superstition Dexter from somewhere near the front of the crowd. "So let it be frustration."
"Frustration to the black iris,"
boomed Epitalus, raising his glass. The cry was echoed from every corner of the crowd, and then with one vast gulp, several hundred people were in pressing need of a refill. Waiters wielding bottles in both hands waded into the fray. When Epitalus had received a fresh supply of wine, he raised his glass again.
"Carthane! Gods bless our great jewel of the West!"
This toast, too, was echoed enthusiastically. But in its wake, Locke witnessed something curious. A fair number of the people around him touched their left hands to their eyes, bowed their heads, and whispered, "Bless the presence."
"Gods grant us all the blessing of a long-awaited victory," said Epitalus, "as they have granted me the honor of your very kind attention. I'll not detain you a moment longer. We have plenty of work to do in the coming 6 weeks, but tonight is for pleasure, and I must insist that you all pursue it vigorously."
Epitalus descended from the elevated gallery to a round of applause that shook the rafters. The musicians started up again.
"What did you think of the old boy?" asked Jean.
"He's got a strangely sunny view of 10 years of defeat," said Locke. "But if I get killed in the next 6 weeks, I want him to speak at my funeral."
"Not to piss on the good cheer," said Jean in a much lower voice, "but did you notice that our friend Nikoros?"
"Yeah," sighed Locke. "We'll straighten him out later." The mass of well-dressed first sons, second sons, third daughters, and the like returned to its previous knots of conversation and besieged the silver platters of food which were now being uncovered at the back of the hall. Performance alchemists in bright silk costumes emerged from the kitchens, some to mix drinks, others already juggling heatless fire or conjuring glowing steam in rainbows of color.
"My compliments, Nikoros," said Locke. "Your party seems to be a smashing success. Something tells me we're not going to be getting any bloody work done before noon tomorrow, though."
"Oh, Justin's your man for that," said Nikoros.
He mixes a hangover remedy that'll knock the fumes right out of your brain. Alchemy ain't in it, so I think we can help ourselves to another glass or two with a clear.
It was then that Locke noticed a new murmur from the crowd near the main doors, not the low purr of drunken contentment, but a spreading signal of unease. Men and women with green ribbons parted like clouds before a rising sun, and out of the gap came a stout, curly-haired man in a pale blue coat and matching four-cornered hat. He carried a polished wooden staff about 3 feet long, topped with a silver figurine of a rampant lion. A tipstaff, if Locke had ever seen one.
"Herald Vidalos," said Nikoros warmly. "The dear fellow, have you come at a fine time? You must take a little something against the chill. Help yourself."
"Deepest regrets, Nikoros." The man called Vidalos had a curiously gentle voice, and it was obvious that he was in some discomfort. "I'm afraid I've come on the business of the magistrate's court."
"Oh?"
Nikoros stiffened.
"Well, perhaps I can help you keep it discreet. Who do you need to see?"
"Diligence Justin." By now a wide circle of the floor had cleared around Vidalos. Justin pushed his way through the crowd and stepped into the open.
"What news, Vidalos?"
"Nothing that gives me any pleasure." Vidalos touched his staff gently to Justin's left shoulder. "Diligence Justin, I serve you before witnesses with a warrant from the magistrate's court of Carthane." He withdrew the staff and handed the innkeeper a scroll sealed inside a case. While Justin broke the seal and unrolled the contents, Locke casually moved to stand beside him.
"What's the trouble?"
he whispered.
"By the 10 fucking holy names," said Justin, running his eyes down the neat, numerous paragraphs on the scroll. "This can't be right. All of my fees are properly paid."
"Your license for the dispensation of ardent spirits is in arrears," said Vidalos. "There's no record that the magistrate's court of the fee having been received for this year."
But I did pay it. I certainly did."
"Justin, sir, I desire to believe you with all my soul, but it's my charge to execute this warrant, and execute it I must, or it's my hide they'll have off on penance day."
"Well, we can settle the business about the records later," said Justin. "Just tell me what I owe and I'll pay it right now."
"I'm forbidden to take fees or penalties in hand, sir," said Vidalos. "As you well know, you'll have to go to the next public proceedings at the magistrate's court."
"But that's 3 days from now. Until then..."
"Until then," said Vidalos quietly, "I'm afraid I'm going to have to disperse this party. After that, it's your choice whether we seal your doors or remove your liquor. It's only a few days, sir."
"Only a few days?" hissed Justin, incredulous.
"Oh, Sabbatha," Locke muttered to himself. "You God's damned artist. Hello to you, too." Interlude. Bastards Abroad. 1. They were 40 miles beyond the border of Greater Camor, on the third morning of their journey, when they passed the first corpse swaying beneath the arching branch of a roadside tree.
"Oh, look," said Carlo, who sat beside Jean at the front of the wagon. "All the comforts of home."
"It's what we do with bandits when there's a spare noose about," said Anatoly Vareska, who was walking beside them munching on a late breakfast of dried figs.
Their wagon led the caravan.
"There's one every mile or two. If the noose is occupied, or it ain't convenient, we just open their throats and shove 'em off the road."
"Are there really that many bandits?"
said Sabatha. She sat atop the wagon with her feet propped on the snoring form of Galdo, who'd kept the pre-dawn watch.
"Beg pardon, it's just that there doesn't seem to be anyone actually lurking about."
She sounded bored.
"Well, there's good and bad times," said the caravan master. "Summer like this, we might see one once a month. Our friend here, we strung him up about that long ago. Been quiet since. But when a harvest goes bad, God's help us, they're in the woods thick as bird shit. And after the war, it's mercenaries and deserters raising hell. I double the guard, and I double my fees, heh."
Locke wasn't sure he agreed that there was nothing lurking. The countryside had the haunted quality he remembered from months he'd once spent learning the rudiments of farm life. All those nights he'd lain awake listening to the alien sound of rustling leaves, yearning for the familiar clamor of carriage wheels, footsteps on stone, boats on water. The old Imperial Road had been built well, but it was starting to crumble now in these remote places between the major powers. The empty garrison forts, silent as mausoleums, were vanishing behind misty groves of cypress and witchwood, and the little towns that had grown around them were reduced to moss-covered ruins and lines in the dirt. Locke walked along beside the wagon on the side opposite Vireska, trying to keep his eyes on their surroundings and away from Sabatha. She'd discarded her rather matronly hood, and her hair fluttered in the warm breeze. She hadn't kept their appointment the second evening. In fact, she'd barely spoken to him at all, remaining absorbed in the plays she'd packed and deflecting all attempts at conversation as adroitly as she'd parried his baton strokes. The caravan, 6 wagons total, trundled along in the rising morning heat. At noon they passed through a thicket like a dark tunnel. A temporarily empty noose swung from one of the high dark branches, a forlorn pendulum. "You know, it was novel at first," said Carlo, "but I'm starting to think the place could use a more cheerful sort of distance marker."
"Bandits would tear down proper signposts," said Vireska, "but they're all afraid to touch the nooses. They say that when you don't hang someone over running water, the rope holds the unquiet soul. Awful bad luck to touch it unless you're giving it a new victim."
"Hmm," said Carlo. "If I was stuck out here jumping wagon trains in the middle of shit-sucking nowhere, I'd assume my luck was already as bad as it gets." 2. They halted for the night in the village of Tresancon, a hamlet of about 200 souls built on 3 marsh-moated hills, protected by stockades of sharpened logs. It was the only kind of settlement that could flourish out here, according to Vireska, too big for bandits to overrun, but too remote to make it worthwhile for parties of soldiers from Camor to pay it a visit for road upkeep taxes. No rural idyll, this. The villagers were sullen and suspicious, more appreciative of outside goods than the outsiders who brought them. Still, the rough hilltop lot they provided for caravans was preferable to any bed awaiting them out in the lightless damps of the wilderness. Locke took his turn sweeping beneath the wagon while Jean saw to the horses. The Sansa twins, grudgingly accepting one another's proximity, wandered off to survey the village. Sabatha remained atop the wagon, guarding their possessions. Locke needed just a few minutes to ensure that the space in which they would set their bedrolls was no embarrassment to civilization, and then it occurred to him that they were more or less alone.
I regret not having a chance to speak to you last night," he said.
"Oh? Was it any real loss to either of us?"
"You had... well, I don't suppose you did promise. You'd said you'd consider it, at least."
"That's right. I didn't promise."
"Well, damn. You're obviously in a mood."
"Am I?"
There was danger in her tone.
"Am I really? Why should that be exceptional? A boy may be as disagreeable as he pleases, but when a girl refuses to crap sunshine on command, the world mutters darkly about her moods."
"I only meant it by way of, well, nothing, really. It was just a conversational note. Look, it's really damned odd having to look for ploys to speak with you, as though we were complete strangers."
"If I'm in a mood," said Sabatha after a moment of reflective silence, "it's because this journey is unfolding more or less as I had foreseen. Tedium, bumpy roads, and biting insects."
"Ah," said Locke. "Do I count as part of the tedium or one of the biting insects?"
"If I didn't know any better," she said softly, "I'd swear the horseshit sweeper was attempting to be charming."
"You might as well assume," said Locke, not sure whether he was feeling bold or merely willing himself to feel bold, "that I'm always attempting to be charming where you're concerned."
"Now that's risky."
Sabatha rolled sideways and jumped down beside him.
"That sort of directness compels a response. But what's it to be? Do I encourage you in this sort of talk, or do I stop you cold?"
She took a step forward,
hands on hips, and despite himself, Locke leaned backward, bracing against the wagon at the last second to avoid a fall that would have been, perhaps, the most graceless thing ever accomplished in the history of Therin civilization. "I get a vote," he said meekly. "If it's not to be encouragement, can you accept being stopped cold?" She raised one finger and touched his chin. It was neither invitation nor chastisement. "The Sansas might be driving us all crazy at the moment, but I will say this on their behalf. When their advances were made and refused, they never brought the subject up again." "Carlo and Galdo made a pass at you?" "Certainly not at the same time," she said. "Why so surprised? Surely you've noticed that you're not the only hot-blooded young idiot with fully functional bits and pieces in our little gang?" "Yes, but they..." "They understand that my feelings for them lie somewhere between sisterly affection and saintly tolerance, and while I sometimes imagine that they would hump trees if they thought nobody was around to see it, they've respected my wishes absolutely. Could you handle disappointment so well?"
"If I'm to be disappointed," said Locke, heart pounding, "I really wish you would cut the prelude and just disappoint me already."
"Ooh, there's some fire at last." Sabitha folded her arms beneath her breasts and edged closer to him. "Tell me, how do you even know for sure that I don't fancy girls?"
"I..." Locke was lucky to spit the one syllable out before the power of coherent speech ran up a white flag and deserted him. "Gods above!"
"You never even thought about that, did you?"
she said, her voice a sly whisper.
"Well, hells, is that... I mean to say, do you?"
"Fancy oysters or snails? What a damned awkward thing to be unsure of for someone in your position. Oh, for Perelandro's sake, you look like you're about to be executed."
She bent over and whispered in his right ear.
"I happen to like snails very well, thank you."
"Ah," he said, feeling the earth grow solid beneath his feet again. "I've never been so pleased at such a comparison before."
"It's a champion among metaphors," she said with the faintest smile. "So very apt."
"And now that you've had your sport with me, do I join Carlo and Galdo in their exclusive little club?"
"They're still my friends." She sounded genuinely hurt. "My oath brothers? That's nothing to scorn, especially for a would-be priest of your order."
"Sabitha, I do fancy you. It scares the hell out of me to admit it, but I say it plainly, as you did the other night. Only I don't say it casually. I have admired you since the instant we met, do you understand? The very instant, that day we went out from Shades Hill to see the hangings. Do you remember?"
"Of course," she whispered. "The strange little boy who wouldn't leave streets. What a sad trial you were. But what was there to admire, Locke? We were dusty, starving little creatures. You couldn't have been 6. What feelings were there to have?"
"I only know they were there. When I heard that you drowned, I felt as though my heart had been stepped on."
"I'm sorry for that. It was necessary."
She glanced away from him for a long moment before continuing.
"I think you look upon our past in the light of your present feelings and imagine some glow that is more reflection than substance."
"Sabitha, I don't remember my own father, and other than a single memory of sewing needles, my mother is as much a mystery. I don't remember where I was born, or the catchfire plague, or how I survived it, or anything that I did before the thief-maker bought me from the city watch."
"Locke,
listen, it's all gone. But the moments I've spent with you, whether you knew I was there or not, they're still with me, smouldering like coals. I can touch them and feel the heat."
"You've been reading too many of Jean's romances. What basis for comparison have you ever had, Locke? You and I have been together all these years. Why wouldn't you evolve some sort of fixation? It's only perfectly natural, expected familiarity."
"Who are you trying to convince?" On the attack now, he played her game, took a step forward. "That doesn't sound like it's meant for my benefit. You're trying to talk yourself out of confiding in me. Why..."
His voice had grown louder with every word, and she startled him by slapping a hand over his mouth. "You are turning something quite personal into a speech for the whole camp," she said in her flawless Vadrin.
"Sorry," he whispered in the same language. "Look, this isn't some damn fixation, Sabitha. If I could just somehow let you see yourself through my eyes, I guarantee your feet would never touch the ground again.
There's magic that might have some useful applications, she said wistfully, if you were to pull that off, and if I were to choose to be charmed just now.
Well, if not now, then...
I told you my feelings for you are complicated. Everything concerning you is complicated, and by that I don't mean that I'm confused or muddle-headed or frightened. I mean that there are actual, genuine circumstances about us and around us that make this difficult. There are obstacles, damn it.
Then tell me about them. Tell me anything I can do. Are we speaking Vadran now?
Said Carlo from his previously silent perch in Sabatha's vacated place atop the wagon.
Oh, Sansa, damn your eyes! Hissed Sabatha. I just about jumped out of my bloody skin!
Now that's praise, said Galdo, who rolled out from beneath the wagon. You're not easy to take unawares. You must have really had your head shoved up your ass, said Carlo.
Are you two back in your usual rhythm, then? Said Locke crossly.
Nah, said Galdo. Just curious is all.
How sharp is your Vadran? Said Locke.
Mine Vadran is great sharp, said Carlo in that tongue, exaggeratedly mangling each word. Perfect like without flaws, am the clever Sansa I being.
I think the two of us are a bit rusty, though, said Galdo. So if you could just repeat all the parts we missed.
Get used to gaps in your comprehension, said Sabatha. The rest of us certainly have.
Village not worth your attention, said Locke with a sigh.
Just the opposite, said Galdo. We thought we'd fetch a few pieces of silver. Some of these smelly hillside mudfuckers are playing cards at what passes for their tavern.
Shouldn't take much of the old Camor flash to dazzle them, said Carlo, making a small rock appear and disappear from the palm of his hand. Could roll off in the morning owning half this bloody place.
I don't think that's wise, said Sabatha.
What are they going to do? Said Galdo. Declare war? Look, if we come back in a few months and find out that 100 swamp country yokels have knocked over the Five Towers, we'll write a sincere apology.
And we only need a few coins anyway, said Carlo, throwing back the tarp over their supplies, to buy in. After that, we'll be taking donations, not giving them.
Hold on, said Locke. Since when are you two criminals?
Since, Carlo squinted and pretended to calculate,
somewhere between first leaving Mother and hitting the ground between her legs, I imagine.
Head first, added Galdo.
I know the Sansas are as crooked as a snake in a clockwork snake-bending machine, said Locke, but the Asino brothers are actors, not card sharps.
You know how actors make a living between engagements, said Carlo.
Believe me, some of them are flash-fucking card sharps. I learned some of my best stuff from...
What I mean... said Locke, is that we should all just be actors, and only actors. I've been thinking about this. No games of opportunity on the way. No more picked pockets. We should draw a line between the people we are in Camor and the people we are in Espara. When we go home, anyone thinking to follow us back to our real lives should find nothing. No hints, no trail.
Seems sensible, said Galdo.
And it starts here, said Locke. It means we don't do anything to make ourselves memorable. You really think your yokel friends will simply let you clean them out and send us on our merry way tomorrow morning?
Someone's going to get cut, Sansas. Everyone in this village will be after your skins, and our guards won't save you. They have to work this route week in and week out. They need these people.
He's right, said Carlo. I knew it was a dumb fucking plan, you bald degenerate.
It was your idea, you greedy turd polisher.
Well, at any rate, said Carlo to Locke, we ain't following through on it.
Then why not start boiling dinner? Or better yet, if you really want to drop a coin in the village, see if you can hunt down some meat that doesn't come in the form of a brick.
The Sansas received this suggestion with enthusiasm and vanished once again down the winding track to what passed for Tresencon's High Street. Locke and Sabatha faced one another in their absence, and Locke detected a sudden coolness in her demeanour.
"That right there," she said, "would be one of the obstacles I mentioned."
"What? You really didn't notice?"
"Notice what? What am I meant to realize?"
"Think about it," she said. She crossed her arms again, this time with her shoulders hunched forward, a protective, unwelcoming gesture.
I'm serious. I'll give you a moment. Think about it.
Think about what?
Years ago, said Sabitha, I was the oldest child in a small gang. I was sent away by my master to train in dancing and manners. When I returned, I found that a younger child had taken my place.
But I hardly...
Carlo and Galdo, who once treated me as a goddess on earth, had transferred their allegiance to the small newcomer. In time, he got himself a third ally, another boy.
That is purest. Why, Jean is devoted to you as a friend.
But not as a particular friend, she said. Not as he is to you.
Is that your obstacle? Locke felt as though a heavy object had just spun out of the darkness and cracked him on the head. My friendship with Jean? Does it make you jealous?
You listen about as well as you observe, said Sabitha. Haven't you ever noticed that suggestions from me are treated as suggestions, while suggestions from you are taken as a sacred warrant, even if those suggestions are identical?
I think you're being very unfair, said Locke weakly.
You saw it just now. I couldn't dissuade the Sansas from drinking arsenic on the strength of mere common sense, but they trip over themselves to take your directions. This is your gang, Locke. It has been since you arrived, and with Chain's blessing. You've been shaped and groomed as Garista for when he's gone, and as, well, as a priest, his replacement.
But I had no notion or intention.
Of course not. You haven't really questioned anything since your arrival. You've assumed a position of primacy, which is easy to take for granted, until you're quietly shuffled out of it. After that, I find the matter never quite leaves one's thoughts.
But I have been worked and tested as sorely as you, said Locke, fighting to keep his voice down. As sorely as anyone. Do you remember how long it took me to pay this off?
He reached down the front of his tunic and pulled out his shark's tooth, ensconced in its little leather bag.
Gods above! I could have a city house and a carriage for the money I poured into this damn thing. And I served as many apprenticeships as...
I'm not talking about your training, Locke. I know what Chains has done to us all. I'm talking about the way you accepted everything as you accept your own skin. Something natural and undeserving of reflection. Well, let me assure you that the only woman in a house of men has frequent cause for reflection.
This is a complete surprise to me, said Locke.
I know, she said softly. That's a problem.
She stared up at the sky, where one of the moons was emerging from behind a low haze of clouds, and Locke had no idea how to begin responding to her.
A week to go, she said at last. A long, slow week of all the pleasures I named earlier. We're going to be tired, sore, smelly, and bitten half to death by the time we reach Aspara. I want to talk to you again, Locke, but I can't bring myself to make it a subject of hopeful anticipation night after night under these circumstances. Neither of us will be at our best.
And this merits our best, he said grudgingly.
I think it does. So can we keep it simple while we're traveling? Eyes on the ground, asses in our seats, and all of these matters tabled until a later date?
You think it's fair to dump this in my lap and then request a conversational truce?
I don't think it's fair at all, she said. Just necessary.
Well, then, if nothing else, it seems I'll have a lot of time to ruminate on an explanation for you.
An explanation? You think what I want out of you is some sort of defense? Surely you can see that I've explained you already. What comes next is...
Yes?
I won't say. I think I need you to tell me.
All you have to do is...
No, she said sharply. I've told you everything you need to know to figure out what comes next. If my words really are like smoldering coals, Locke, then let these ones smolder. Sift them, and bring me an answer sometime after we reach Aspara. Bring me a good answer.
3. Aspara, formerly a seat of prestige only one step below Therimpel itself, had descended from its imperial years the way some men and women descend into middle-aged lethargy, discarding the vigor and ambition of youth like a suit of clothes that can no longer be wriggled into. Locke caught his first glimpse of the place just after noon on the 10th day, when the caravan turned the bend between two ruin-studded hills and entered the familiar, irregular green and brown whirls of a farming landscape. On the southern horizon lay the faint shapes of towers under curling grey smears of smoke.
"Espara," said Anatoly Vereska, "right where I left it. No more stops for rest, my young friends. Before the sun sets, you'll be in the city looking for your actor fellows."
"Well done, caravan master," said Locke, who had the reins while Jean was snoring gently under the tarp at the rear of the wagon. "Not what I'd call a scenic tour, but you've brought us through without a scratch."
"When the crop of bandits is thin, it's a restful little walk. Now it's back to dodging carriages, breathing smoke, and paying rent for the beds you sleep in, eh?"
"Gods be praised," said Locke.
"City creatures are the strangest of all," said Vereska,
with a friendly shake of his head. He moved off to visit the rest of the wagons. All the gentleman bastards, more or less as footsore, ass-sore, unwashed and drained of blood as Sabatha had predicted, had given up on walking this morning. Carlo and Galdo leaned against each other, watching the landscape roll by at its strolling pace, while Sabatha was absorbed in the copy of the Republic of Thieves she'd picked up before they'd left Camor.
"Is the play any good?" said Galdo.
"I think so," said Sabatha. "Except the final act has been torn out of this folio, and half the pages have stains blotting out some of the lines. I keep imagining that every scene ends with the characters hurling cups of coffee at one another."
"Sounds like my kind of play," said Carlo.
"Are there any decent roles?" said Galdo.
"They're all decent," said Sabatha. "Better than decent. I think they're very romantic. We should have names like this, like all the heroes in these plays, all the famous bandits and sorcerers and emperors."
"Most people could give half a dry shit for having an emperor's name," said Galdo. "It's the wealth and power they'd want."
"What I mean," said Sabatha, "is that we should have aliases like out of the old stories. Big, grand titles like the 10 Honest Turncoats, you know? Red Jessa, the Duke of Knaves. Amadine, the Queen of Shadows."
"I think Verena Galante is a fine alias," said Locke.
"No, I mean big and important and uncommon. Not something you get called to your face. The sort of alias that people whisper when something unbelievable happens. Oh, gods, this can only be the work of the Duke of Knaves."
"Heavens," said Galdo in a deep, dramatic voice. "Only one man living could have squeezed forth such a gleaming brown jewel. This is the work of Squatting Carlo, the Midnight Shitter."
"You two want for imagination," said Sabatha.
"Not at all," said Galdo. "The lower the enterprise, the hotter the fire of our invention burns."
"Are you going a bit stir-crazy, Sabatha?"
said Locke, secretly pleased to hear the energy in her voice after so many days of brooding tedium.
"Maybe I am. I've been stuck in this wagon counting Sansa farts for a week. Maybe I'm due a little flight of fancy. I mean, wouldn't it be grand to have a legend that grew while you were alive to enjoy it? To sit in a tavern and hear all the people around you speaking of what you'd done, with no notion that you were among them as flesh and blood."
"I can sit in a tavern and be ignored any time I please," muttered Carlo.
"I want to see the Kingdom of the Marrows some day," said Sabatha. "Game my way from city to city, on the arms of nobles, emptying their pockets as I go, charming them witless. I'd be like a force of nature. They'd come up with some elegant title for their shared affliction. It was her. It was the rose."
Sabatha rolled this off her tongue, obviously savoring it.
"The Rose of the Marrows, they'll say. The Rose of the Marrows has been my ruin. And they'll tear their hair out explaining everything to their wives and bankers while I ride on to the next city."
"Are we all going to need stupid nicknames then?" said Carlo. "We could be the Shrubs of the North."
"The Weeds of Vintilla," said Galdo.
"And if you're a rose," said Carlo, "Locke's going to need something as well."
"He can be a tulip," said Galdo. "Delicate little tulip."
"Nah, if she's the rose, he can be her thorn." Carlo snapped his fingers.
"The Thorn of Camor. Now that's got some shine to it."
"That's the dumbest fucking thing I've ever heard," said Locke.
"We can do it as soon as we get home," said Carlo.
disguise ourselves, drop hints in bars, tell stories here and there. Give us a month and everyone will be talking about the Thorn of Camor. Even the ones that don't know shit will just tell more lies so they can sound like they're clued in on the latest.
If you ever do anything like that, said Locke, I swear to all the gods I will murder you.
4. Just after the fourth hour of the afternoon, with the faintest warm drizzle sweating out of the graying sky, their wagon rolled through the mud beneath the stone arch of the Jalan River Gate on the east side of Espara. Jean was back at the reins, and he bade their horses to halt for a squad of armed men in cloaks.
"What goes, Viresca?"
said the evident leader, one of those graceful hulking types, the sort that gave every impression of being able to dance a minuet despite possession of a belly fit for carving into ham steaks.
"We could set a water clock by you. Dull trip, eh?"
"Just the way it ought to be,"
said the caravan master as he shook hands with the watchman. The gratuity that instantly vanished into the heavy fellow's pocket was generous. Viresca had discussed it back in Camor and collected an equal portion from each wagon owner.
"Now, when you're poking through everything, watch, Sergeant, just be especially delicate with the drugs and the hidden weapons, eh?"
"I promise not to keep you more than 10 hours this time," laughed the big Esparan.
His men made an extremely cursory examination of the wagons, clearly more for the benefit of anyone watching than for the enforcement of the city's customs laws.
"Welcome," said one of the guards to Sabatha, who'd once again donned all her more modest clothing. "First time in Espara?"
"Actually, yes," she said.
"Might we help you find anything?"
said the big watch sergeant, edging in next to his man.
"Oh, that would be so very kind of you,"
she said, bubbling with girlish charm. Locke bit his tongue to stifle a snicker.
"We're looking for a man called Jasma Moncrane, the Moncrane Company, the actors."
"Why?" said the watch sergeant. "You creditors?"
All the men behind him burst into laughter.
"Ah, no," she said. "We're players from Camor, come to join his troupe."
"They got theatres in Camor, miss?" said one of the guards. "I thought she was all more about, like, sharks biting women in half."
"I'd like to see that," mumbled another watchman.
"There is an awful lot of that where we come from," said Sabatha. "In fact, we spend more time touring than at home. Moncrane's engaging us for the rest of the summer."
"Well," said the watch sergeant, "in that case, best of luck. You can find some of the Moncrane Company at, what's that place with the olive tree torn out of its courtyard?"
"Gloriano's rooms," said another guard.
"Right, right, Gloriano's," said the sergeant. "Look, you follow this lane straight down to the Temple of Venaportha, and just past it turn left, hear? Take that lane across the river. You're in a place we call Solace Hill. Gloriano's rooms would be on your right. If you find gravestones on three sides, you've gone too far."
"We're obliged to you," said Locke, while nursing a faint premonition that that might not, in the grand scheme of things, turn out to be entirely true. They parted company with Viresca's caravan and made their way into Espara, hewing to the watch sergeant's directions. It seemed to Locke that they all perked up considerably at finding themselves back in the familiar world of high stone walls, rain-dampened smoke, junk-strewn alleys, and people crammed elbow to elbow on the dry portions of the boulevards.
"Three cheers for a proper ale," said Galdo wistfully. "In a proper tavern that doesn't have a fucking palisade built round it to keep out the bloody bog monster."
"I think this is Solace Hill," said Jean, as they entered a neighbourhood that seemed to regress further from prosperity with every turn of the wagon wheels.
The buildings grew lower, the windows became dirtier, and the lights grew fewer.
"Look, that's a graveyard. This Gloriano's has to be close."
They found it not a block down, the best-lit structure from some distance in any direction, though the illumination was perhaps unwise, given the things it revealed about the condition of walls and roofs. A pair of city watchmen, looking soaked behind the misty glow of their lanterns, were standing in the turn to the inn-yard and impeding the passage of the gentleman bastard's wagon.
"Is there a problem, constables?" called Jean.
"You don't actually mean to turn in here?" said one of the men warily, as though he suspected himself the butt of a joke.
I think we do, said Jean.
But this is the way to Gloriano's innyard, said the constable, even more warily.
Pleased to hear it.
You delivering something?
Just ourselves, said Jean.
God above, you mean it, said the constable. I could tell you ain't from here, even if I never heard your voice.
He and his companions stepped out of the way with exaggerated courtesy and walked on, shaking their heads. Locke first heard the shouting as Jean brought them in under a sloping canvas awning that was more holes than fabric, next to a dark stable that contained only one horse. The animal looked at them as though in hope of rescue.
"What the hell is that noise?" said Sabatha.
It wasn't any sort of row that Locke recognized. Fisticuffs, theft, murder, domestic quarrel, all of those things had familiar rhythms and notes, sounds he could have identified in a second. This was something stranger, and it seemed to be coming from just around the right-hand corner of the building.
"Jean, Sabatha, come quietly with me," he said. "Sansas, mind the horses. If they have any brains, they might try to bolt."
It didn't occur to him until his boots hit the mud that he'd again done precisely what Sabatha had railed against, presumed leadership without hesitation. But damn it, this wasn't a time for putting his life under a magnifying lens. It was a time for making sure they weren't all about to be murdered.
"I shall break you, joint by joint," bellowed a man with a deep, attention-seizing voice, "and drink your screams like a fine wine, and burn in brighter ecstasy with every fading whimper from your coward's throat."
"Holy shit," said Locke. "No, wait. That's from a play."
"Catalinus, last prince of Amor Peth," whispered Jean.
Side by side, Locke, Jean, and Sabatha moved carefully around the corner. They found themselves facing a courtyard, the interior of three double-storied wings of the inn, with a vast ugly hole in the middle where something had been torn out of the ground. A man and a woman sat off to one side, out of the light, watching a third man who stood on the edge of the muddy hole with a bottle in either hand. This man was a prodigious physical specimen, surpassing Father Chains in girth and breadth, with a rain-slick crown of white hair pasted down around his creased face. He wore a loose grey robe and nothing else.
"I shall grind your bones to powder," he hollered, transfixing the three gentlemen bastards with his gleaming eyes. "And with that dust I'll make cement for paving stones, and for 100 years to come you'll have no rest beneath the crush of strange wheels and the tramp of strange boots. Drunkards will make their unclean water upon you, and I shall laugh to think of it, Catalinus. I shall laugh until I die, and I shall die whole in body, wholly revenged upon thee."
He flung forth his arms, perhaps intentionally, perhaps at random, and when he seemed to realize that he still held bottles in his hands, he drank from them.
"Excuse me," said Locke. Thunder rumbled overhead. The rain grew heavier. "We're, looking for the Moncrane Company."
"Moncrane!"
yelled the white-haired man, dropping one of his bottles and waving his arms to keep his balance at the edge of the hole.
"Moncrane!"
"Are you Jasma Moncrane?" said Jean.
"I, Jasma Moncrane?"
The man leapt down into the hole, which was about thigh deep, raising a dark splash of water. He scrambled up the other side and came toward them, now thoroughly bemucked from the waist down.
"I am Sylvanus Olivios Andrassus, the greatest actor in 1,000 miles, in 1,000 years. Jasma Moncrane wishes, on his best day, that he was worth a single drop of my piss."
Sylvanus Olivios Andrassus shambled forward and put his empty hand on Jean's shoulder.
"Stupid boy," he said, "I need you to let me have 5 royals just until penance day. Oh, gods."
He went down to one knee and threw up. Jean's reflexes were sharp enough to save everything except one of his shoes.
"Fuck me," said Jean.
"Oh, no, I assure you, that is quite out of the question," said Sylvanus.
He attempted several times to stumble back to his feet,
then once again noticed the remaining bottle in his hand and began to suckle at it contentedly.
"Look, sorry about this," said the woman who'd been watching, as she emerged from the shadows. She was tall, dark-skinned, and wearing a shawl over her hair. Her fellow spectator was a thin young Therin man just a few years older than the gentleman bastards. "Sylvanus has what you might call rare ambition in the field of self-degradation."
"Are you the Moncrane Company?" said Locke.
"Who wants to know?" said the woman hesitantly.
"I'm Lucasa de Barra," said Locke. "This is my cousin, Giovanno de Barra, and this is our friend Verena Galante."
When this elicited no response, Locke cleared his throat.
"We're Moncrane's new players, the ones from Camor."
"Oh, sweet gods above," said the woman. "You're real."
"Yeah," said Locke, and, wet and confused.
"We thought, well, look, we didn't think you existed. We thought Moncrane was making you up."
"Took 10 slow days in a wagon to get here," said Jean. "Let me assure you, nobody made us up."
"I'm Genora," said the woman, "and this is Alondo." "Alondo Razi," said the young man. "Weren't there supposed to be more of you?"
"The Asino brothers are minding the wagon back around the corner," said Locke. "So, we're flesh and blood. I guess the next question is, does Jasma Moncrane exist?"
"Moncrane," muttered Sylvanus, "wouldn't shit on his head to give him shade from the sun."
"Moncrane," said Genora, "is why Sylvanus is, making a clean..."